Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today I have a really important show on, one that I'm looking forward to. We're going to speak today with Ms. Lynette Zhang. She has held the position of Chief Market Analyst at ITM Trading since 2002. She's been in the markets on some level since 1964 as a banker, a stockbroker, and while studying world currencies since 1987. Her goal is to translate financial noise into understandable language and enable educated, independent choices. All of her work is evidence-based, and she shares her research and experience openly. She believes strongly that we need to be as independent as possible, and at the same time, we need to come together in community in order to survive and thrive through this hyperinflation and these economic times that are questionable, to put it mildly. Her motto is food, water, energy, security, community, barterability, and wealth preservation. And I think all of those things are timely because we're living in times that I don't think I've ever thought we would see, but knowledge is power, and being able to negotiate this is what's going to get us back on track. So, Ms. Zhang, I'd like to thank you so much for joining me today, and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Well, I'd like to thank you for having me, and I'm looking forward to it as well. And thank you for that very wonderful introduction.
It's my pleasure. Let's get right to it. You know, this whole economic shutdown has been made a dramatic difference in everybody's lives. I can speak to being an independent doctor and having my practice be severely affected. I mean, we've been working part-time throughout this crisis. And what people are, I don't know, it seems to me a bit of a fear mentality. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to have you come on because I want to talk about the facts. Do you think that we're going to, first, let's go over the overview. Do you think we'll be able to recover from this economic shutdown?
Well, I think it depends on your definition of recovery. I think on the other side of this, that we will be, well, what they're talking about is a new normal. So right. I think some will fare just fine through it, but I think we will be in a completely new financial system on the other side of this.
Well, actually, that's a great segue. What do you foresee this new financial system being? Is it still going to be central bank driven? Or is it going to be more of a independent, entrepreneurial, more decentralized approach?
Well, I hope it's the latter. But if people don't come together in community and say no, it will probably be central bank driven. But here's the thing. You know, when I look at currency life cycles and when there's a shift from one financial system into another financial system, there are always the same things. History repeats itself. So you can see the same kind of fear, the same kind of confusion, the same kind of, even politics where it's really about making you look in one direction when they're changing everything in the other direction. Mm-hmm. And when I'm looking at this, would the public have tolerated another experience like we had in 2008 with the bailout of the big banking system and the corporations? No, it wasn't that long ago. People are still haven't fully recovered from it. So they would not have tolerated that. Mm-hmm. I can't say that I ever saw a pandemic coming, honestly, because who knew? But I knew that it had to be a huge black swan event. And I think that this event, I cannot prove that it was planned, but I went into the lab in Wuhan and I looked at the reports that came out of there, and they really had, it wasn't just China and Wuhan. I mean, this was a global mix of scientists that what? Were working on creating a super bug. So not just taking the coronavirus that they had with SARS and in the Middle East, SARS, same kind of coronavirus there, but they actually worked on making it this much more lethal. And So while I cannot prove that this was a planned pandemic, it is an awfully convenient pandemic because the system was already dying before that. It died in 2008.
Well, I would add to what you stated, and I think you're right on track, just the fact that they were working on something to something called gain of function, which is to make it more lethal, doesn't make a lot of sense. And just the fact that that existed put everybody at risk for an accident to happen for any untoward event. So it wasn't a bright idea in the scheme of things. But now that it's, you know, we have to deal with what is now.
Yeah.
And this has become, to me, a political football. And there's people who stand to gain by this continuing. That's how I see it. And I think it's on all sides, right? I don't think it's just politics. For me, I have to consider the health side of it. Proponents of single payer have been crowing about single payer for 10 years or so now. And I see this mindset of now it's our chance to bring in single payer and to break the system. And what people don't really understand is that what they want to bring in is doubling down on the most expensive, the least least access, and the most top-down approach to healthcare. I took a Hippocratic oath. I cannot do certain things. I can't kill somebody. I can't ration care from them. My job is to be an advocate. This system is the antithesis of that, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm not in the medical field, though my brother, both my brothers were, and my daughter is. But, you know, it is your health and it is your wealth in that order of importance.
Mm-hmm.
And I really haven't even heard anybody talk about the healthcare, you know, how to boost your immune system.
Exactly.
You know, nobody's talking about that. So I think that's really interesting because what I've watched over the years is the absolute destruction of the food system so that when people are eating food, it's really just empty calories.
Oh, I totally agree with that. You know, when I was years ago, thought to myself, you know, the big farming industry, the fact that the cattle are not really eating grass anymore, it's more corn, it's all this fake chemicals coming into the system, antibiotics. I didn't think this was going to be a good thing from a health perspective. And cholesterol's gone through the roof. Diabetes has gone through the roof. And I think our food supply should be a lot better. But we have to make conscious choices. If something is easy, doesn't necessarily, or cheap, doesn't necessarily mean that you should go for it. And an educated consumer, I don't care where it is very important, instead of someone leading you down the path. I think it's now a wake-up call that people need to start thinking about what's good for them, not as a group or a tribe, but as for them and their family. Is this going to serve me? Or am I going to listen to some voice that doesn't really have my best interest at heart, but tells me I should think a certain way because it's trendy or because it's politically correct? I think people need to, it's a crossroads in my...
Exactly. And, you know, I was so anxious to be on your show because, of course, as a doctor, your focus is on health. And, you know, for me, they go hand in hand. They made wealth far more important than health. But yet, during these transitions into new systems, food becomes the single biggest item for most people. And we got a little taste of what happened in the grocery store.
We did. We absolutely did.
I hope that's a wake-up call. I've been working on my urban farm here, and the water that comes onto it is filtered, you know, so I know everything that goes into my food. And I've been walking around here when that hit and subsequently and going, thank God I did this. And I've been able to help a lot of people, provide food for a lot of people, you know, because of this. But if you're not eating and you're not thinking clearly. So that's why for me, these are not two different sides. These go hand in hand, health and wealth, because you have to be able to make those educated choices about both of those aspects. And we need people to pay attention.
I absolutely agree. On that note, let's take our first break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Ms. Lynette Zhang. And one of the things that we just discussed was about the food supply, which is extremely important. I'd like to also segue into the wealth side of this. And I'd like to go back to when we did our first bailout. How does that bailout compare to this one, where it seemed, you know, before it was all about the banks, not about middle America? It seems like there was a little trickle down, but what's your take on it? Did it work?
No, it did not work. All it did was paper over the problems and enable them to get a whole lot larger. And so here we're going into this financial crisis where they did shut down the global economy. They shut it down, not just in one little place, but everywhere. People are a lot more aware of the supply chains. But it's justification for a new surveillance economy. And I did a piece on that not that long ago. And I got to tell you, you know, it makes me extremely uncomfortable because you are now going to have everything in very, very, you know, monitored. Everything will be monitored. Where right. you go, what you do. Once they get us into the digital system, I mean, dirty cash. Ew, ew. Who wants dirty cash? Mm-hmm. Let alone dirty gold and silver, which is an old relic. Who needs those? Just go digital. And then what the government says is that it gives them the opportunity to do lifetime taxation. So it's time to pay your taxes. Boop. It just disappears from your account. You have zero control. And for central bankers, right now, it takes about 18 months from when they start a policy till they see if they get the results that at least that they say that they want. Whereas once everything is digital, then they can go as deeply negative on interest rates as they want to. And there's really, other than physical gold in your possession out of the system, there's not anything else that you can do with it. Although what they call current cash that does not have the tracking chips in it, mm-hmm. cash in the wild. So that would go for a premium because it would not be automatically depreciating by, you know, by a clock, so to speak.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't money of any kind have to have something tangible? It's a token for something else, right? So how does something digital have value? Because it's not tied to anything.
Well, you know, you kind of have to move backwards in order to move forward, because the original intention of money was to enable a society to specialize. So you have a doctor, you have a baker, you have a farmer, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so they needed a tool to fairly value labor. And they tried many, many things over the years, but only gold meets all of the criteria to be a good money. And it's one of the things is it's indestructible. So we can account for pretty much all of the gold that's ever existed, which makes accounting easy. Plus, it is divisible without loss of value. If you divide a diamond, okay, now it loses its value. But you can divide gold, and it can be in any form, and it's still monetary at its base, and it still has that base value. But for governments, if they wanted to tax you, well, then you'd know about it on a gold standard. So they shifted us to what's called a fiat standard. And the literal translation of fiat is by decree. So it's a government-based system. So initially, yes, once we went off of the full gold standard, well, then there was a shift into the fiat standard, and inflation was part of that design, because inflation causes what they call nominal confusion. People get married to numbers. You look at the stock market going up and you think, isn't that a wonderful thing? However, because of inflation and because of all of this money printing, the value, the purchasing power value of that currency is declining and officially has lost around 98% of its value. And that's official according to the Federal Reserve. Anybody can Google Fed purchasing power of the consumer dollar. So today, what backs our currency is credit, or the ability to grow more debt. And that's what the system is based on. Never ending, continuously rolling over debt. But whether you're a government, a corporation, or an individual, there are going to be limits to how much debt you can accumulate. And for governments, it's based upon credibility and how much the public trusts the government, the central bankers, and the currency. And so money can be anything as long as everybody agrees to work for it and to use it as their tool of barter. But what people really need to understand is it is not one of the key components of money originally was as a way to hold value over time so that no matter when I use that money, I was always being fairly paid for my labor. That is just the opposite in the current system. Everybody knows that the longer that you hold that money, the less it's going to buy you, right? I mean, I think everybody knows that. I don't know when it became okay, because it wasn't okay in 1971 in the late 70s or through the 70s when we were dealing with double-digit inflation and stagflation as we transitioned into a pure debt-based system. And the other part of that that is huge is that when Nixon took us off the gold standard, which doesn't sound so bad, what he actually did was hand over full power to central banks of inflation. And what do bankers know? They know debt and they know interest. So private enterprise has been in control of our money supply since 71. And that's why we have no purchasing power at all left.
From the standpoint of unhooking ourselves from the central bank, mm-hmm. is that something that would correct the problem, because it's us controlling our own destiny as opposed to a middleman exactly. making money off of both ends.
Exactly. And that's why gold and silver are more important today than they have ever been in history, because it's the only money that's actually out of the system. And therefore, I mean, they can control how we think about gold and silver. That's what the spot markets are all about mm-hmm. and different things that they do. But, I mean, it's critical that you own gold and silver outside of the system if you want to maintain any level of freedom and become your own central bank.
What do you think about the idea of a public bank? Have you heard of that?
I have heard of that. And as long as it is... I just think at this juncture, we need to be very, very autonomous. We need to be as independent as possible.
Okay.
I'm just not sure that handing over the money supply to anybody else is a good idea. Maybe you can talk about what you think more about the public bank from what you've read.
Well, my understanding is there is no middleman and there is no profit margin for the bank itself. Its job is to help their citizens in their state or whoever is part of their bank. So there's no pressure for stockholders. There's no it's kind of a counterintuitive. Their goal is to an average bank or a commercial bank is to take in money and keep it, right? Not really lend it out because they're making profit on what they're able to. Well, actually, I digress. I'm sorry. It is to lend it out and to make a profit. But to lend it out when they can't even afford to pay it back if everybody called in a loan at the same time. So this is something that's tangible, real, works for the benefit of the people in the public bank without a secondary side benefit for the bank itself. So I think North Dakota was the first one up in the state, or I think it might be the only state to actually have one. And apparently they've been running at a profit since they started, which I thought was pretty fascinating.
Well, I'll have to look more at it, but where would they get the money from to lend?
I think part
of the whole system is a credit system, you know, and I think that may be changing, but you know, the problem is where is the money to start with? Who's controlling that? Right now it's borrowed into existence.
Right.
How is it going to come into existence?
I got you. I'd have to do more research on that, but I think the state itself, I don't know if they take it out some of it in taxes, I'm not sure. But I do know at least there's no middleman and there's no profit margin or pressure to make a profit. It's just be a resource for the citizens of your state. And, you know, we're at a hard break. So I guess I'm going to think about that a little longer. And I want to ask you, if you had your choice, what would this reset mean that would help everybody? So let's think about that and let's take our second break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Ms. Lynette Zhang. And before the break, I was asking a question about what you would do. We kind of discussed the system that we have, the system that came before, and one idea of how we have an alternate version of it. But if you could run this show, which would probably be a really good thing, actually. I'm sure it's better than what we got. How would you make it so that we stop working and not getting paid for our labor, basically getting punished for being successful?
Well, yeah. Punished for just buying into the system, but the money would, and that's the foundation of it. So I don't see that we could go back to 100% back currency, but I would definitely put gold as a component of the currency. And I would probably mandate that rate be fixed, because we probably will in the new system for a minute or two have gold in there, because they're going to need people to have confidence in it again. Mm-hmm. So I would mandate that would be fixed. And as soon as you did that, that also then limits the level of debt that governments can take on. So they would have to balance the budgets and live within their means. What a concept. But then you would have a stable value over time, so you would be more fairly paid for your labor and cut out a lot of this fat. The level of government intervention that corporations do through lobbyists is truly disgusting. It's disgusting beyond what I can even say. And I would also maintain cash in the system, and also gold and silver coin in the system, so that you would be able to transact and maintain a certain level of privacy. Would that be abused? Probably, but you've got a few people that are abusing it versus the many that are paying for that abuse right now. And it's just an excuse anyway, because the creators of the system are clearly abusing it. Yeah, I mean, look what look what he did in 2008, and look what Fed Chair Powell did today. Now they're buying ETFs, junk bonds, corporate bonds. They're bailing out the corporations and just giving the public a little sprinkling of something so that they can say, hey, look, we're taking care of the little guy now. But that's what I would do, is I would have a very stable money supply and create limitations.
Well, I have another way to a question about the concept of a jubilee. If we're all going to start in a reset, why can't we also as individuals start as a reset? We're paying for mistakes that banks made for something that we never did. And why can't we all start over? So give everybody a haircut, maybe drop everybody's debt by a certain percentage or wipe it out. Student loans for 50 years, paying that back. I'm sure people have paid for what they took out initially. Something like that. Is that reasonable, that concept of a jubilee?
Well, right now, in some ways, we're inside of a jubilee, because People don't have to pay, as long as they are government backed, they don't have to pay their mortgages. They don't have to pay their student loans. And there is a rent moratorium going on. So in some ways, there is a bit of a jubilee, but it doesn't get rid of that debt. I do think that it could definitely make some sense. History would tell us that they're not likely to wipe out the debts of the public. Public will still have those debts, but it would be more fair if everybody got the same. And then corporations around that next rim, so they get the money first, and then the government gets it after that. By the time it comes to you, it has a whole lot less value. But I do believe that we will see some form of universal basic income before the end of this year, because 70% of the economy is consumer driven. And with unemployment over 30 million and headed to, you know, who knows, 50, 60 million. If you don't have money, it's kind of hard, and you can't have access to credit or take on more debt. And the debt levels of consumers have just now hit an all-time high. Then how can they consume if they're not earning it? And minimum wage, please give me a break, because you have to go back to when they started the fiat system and they said, okay, what are the benefits for governments? Well, for governments, inflation is an invisible tax that they do not have to go to the legislature to get agreement on. So they can keep that hidden from the public. Corporations, they wanted people to be willing to work for less. And so inflation makes you think that you're making more money, but its value is that much less. So a great example, my father was a developer. He built very nice homes. And one day, this nice young couple, and they came to the house. And after they left, my mother pounded her fist on the table. And she goes, "He's a comer. He makes $12,000 a year." The average wage, this would have been like 1971-ish. Mm-hmm. And the average wage at that time was $9,500. And a family of four could live, I'm not saying, you know, great guns, but they only needed one wage earner to support a family of four. So with him making $12,000 a year, they had a very nice house. So, I mean, I was really 10 when I started to get into this whole piece, not understanding it, but you know, understanding how the trend cycles of tangibles work, et cetera. And that really stood in my mind. So what if somebody made $12,000 a year today, right? So I think the average wage now is something like $53,000 or $56,000, something like that. And so most people will go, well, yeah, I'd much rather make $53,000 than $12,000 or $9,500, of course, except that $53,000 buys a whole lot less than that $9,500, and you need two wage earners. And even at that, you've got almost half the population that cannot put $400 together in an emergency. And I say this is an emergency.
Yeah, agreed. Let's take our last break, because I have a question about what the government is proposing or will jumpstart the economy. Let's take our last break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Ms. Lynette Zhang. And look, before the break, we talked about the value of money. And I think kind of a top-down approach, where we get the money from the government in universal income, et cetera. What about payroll tax reduction or, you know, lowering the taxes that we actually pay? So what we make, we get to keep more of, instead of giving up 50% in some cases, or getting double tax if you're a small business owner. Maybe if we had more money from that standpoint, the government should shrink. We should keep more money instead of them giving us largesse of the government, giving us something and we're supposed to like it. I want to live on more than $1,200 basic income a month or whatever that they're going to give us. It's not going to be enough.
And no, it's never going to be enough.
No, I'd rather make it on my own, because when they decide that they're going to pull it back or they're having a crisis and you can't pay it. And for me, the government's always going to take it if they could. Again, let's use health as an example. It turns out that California is proposing that people who are on public assistance have to test for the COVID virus. And if they don't, they won't get their benefits. This is the kind of thing that if we let the government run amok, they're going to control us based on the short hairs, which is the purse string. I don't want the government to do that for me. I want to do it for myself. So if we stop taxing people so much, Then those people making $12,000 would keep 90% of it, for example, maybe. They wouldn't need all this extra help from the government. What's your take on that?
You know, again, it goes back to needing a more fair monetary system, because it's not the numbers. It's like 9,550 versus 53,000. When we go into that basic universal income, then, and not even when we do that, I mean, all of this money printing, they've got another proposal in Congress for another $3 trillion into this system, and they've already done, you know, it could even be quadrillions, but those are just numbers. And it's the purchasing power that actually impacts you and me, not the number of dollars that we take in, but what we can actually purchase with it. Mm-hmm. So it has to start there in a new monetary system, in a new money and currency that is a lot more fair and stable, because what we have right now is very, very unstable. And even the universal basic income, you know, the assumption is that $1,200 buys today is what it'll buy down the road. And I got news for you. Nope, that ain't gonna happen. Because, you know, I mean, think about, for anything, if somebody hands you, here's a great example. You go to the grocery store, you buy a pint of strawberries and you're making a smoothie, and it costs you, the pint costs you, I don't know, because I don't do that. But let's say it cost you like $3 to buy that pint of strawberries. It was easy. You picked it up, you put it in your cart, you dump the whole thing in your smoothie and you drink it and it's great. Mm-hmm. But I'm growing my strawberries and I know the blood and the sweat and the time it takes to cultivate it and really make that beautiful. And so I have a strawberry, and I'm telling you right now, I eat it a teeny weeny bit at a time and I savor it. And money would not be any different. If it comes to you easily, it has a whole lot less value than if it comes to you through a lot of hard work. So universal basic income, modern money theory, where they don't even have to grow debt, just print the money. Yeah. I mean, that is what's going to set us into that hyperinflation. We're already in depression, but so a hyperinflationary depression. And that will finish off this system. Mm-hmm. And, you know, right now, even though people are scared, they're not as scared, I hate to say this, but they're not as scared as they're going to be. It's about to get, this is the health part of it, but mm-hmm. the next part is the wealth part of it, where you hit that 50,000 or 50 million, 60 million jobless people. And, you know, you see corporate bankruptcy after corporate bankruptcy after corporate bankruptcy. And I think it's going to get very scary out there, because, you know, you talk about a trickle down effect. Mm-hmm. Well, let's see, if you don't pay your mortgage, then what happens to the servicers of those mortgages? So what the government did, they capped that servicers, so whoever you send that monthly check to, servicers are only responsible for a maximum of 4 months of that mortgage payment. Okay, which doesn't include taxes and interest, insurance. Okay, now if it's a Fannie or Freddie mortgage, they're going to keep paying that. They have to, because the servicer pays the products that Wall Street created from that mortgage debt that individuals buy to generate income. And the last thing that they want anybody, any individuals to know, is that the system is dead. So they've got a problem. And so that's why they have to, number one, if people can't pay their mortgage, this is different than, you know, I mean, they have to do the mortgage moratorium, but they also have to then do tax dollars to pay the servicers. So the servicers can then put them into those products, those Wall Street products, so that people will still keep holding on to those products or keep buying into it. And I'll tell you what really scares me like crazy, honestly, is we have been so trained to buy the dips. We have been so trained that value does not matter, that people are not taking this opportunity to get out of the stock and the bond market, to get out of those paper markets that are so highly leveraged. Mm-hmm. Even these government programs were built in so that they can be leveraged 10 to 1. 10 to 1. Now, and that's chump change, because the corporations that they're already bailing out, the fallen angels, so to speak, that, I mean, I've done enough research to see, just like the grading services going into 2008 had paid, you know, played really footloose and fancy free with, yeah, we don't need evidence. And no, you don't have to be that great credit worthy, or we'll just kind of juggle the numbers, you know, the liar loans. They've been doing the same thing with these corporate bond markets. And the area of triple B, which is where the fallen angels that are getting bailed out by the government is right now, they should have never been triple B. They were already below investment grade level in the level of leverage and debt that they were carrying. And a lot of this, and Japan introduced this, aren't they great? I mean, we are completely Japanized with what we do. I mean, their government buys stocks, they buy bonds, they buy ETFs, and now our government does too.
Right.
What's the difference? But you have all these zombie corporations. It's a zombie corporation. It's a corporation for at least 3 years did not generate enough income to pay the interest on the debt. Forget the principal. Okay. So they're basically insolvent. And because the banks did not want you to know that they had all these bad loans on the books, they loaned them money to pay the interest on the debt. So they enabled them to take on more debt so that they would look solvent when they're not solvent. So there's no way that this can end well. There is no flipping way on God's green earth that this can end well. And that's what we have coming up shortly, that they just can't bail all of that out. So what's a 2,000, 4,000 universal basic income when the currency won't buy you anything?
You know what's interesting about what you just said? When you talk about the huge corporate welfare system that's out there, and you look at the small business side of it, the small business side is doing what they're supposed to do. There's no, we don't get these loans. We have to be aggressive. We have to be entrepreneurial in order to stay in business. And we're not taking loans like this, but we're going to get sucked right down along with it, or at least hopefully not. I think we can weather the storm because we actually provide a service, most of us. Mm-hmm. So it's value as opposed to fake value. If that's a good way to see it, it's kind of sad. This whole system is completely screwed up and we're paying for the mistakes of somebody else who got bailed out. But you know, I'm a big picture person and the Congress is right along with them passing laws and giving them, you get a lobby, get a dinner, talk about doctors getting pens like it's going to make us prescribe. These guys are getting money. They're getting help to get back in. That's a whole nother level. The system's broken. It seems like it should be wiped off and start over again from what you just said.
Well, and that's the reset. That's the reset.
Okay.
And so, yes, I mean, we have to, because the tools to keep this game going, which are interest rates, right? Interest rates are supposed to reflect the demand for credit. But, you know, once they dropped interest rates to zero, and look, that's a 30-year trend.
Right? Yeah.
After we transitioned into a debt-based system, then the government, the Federal Reserve, pushed interest rates at one point up to 21.75%. So they had all that ramp room. And every time we would get into a crisis, the average level that they would push interest rates down to inspire more debt accumulation was 5.5% or 5.75%. We've been anchored at zero since 2008. And I said this right along because it was just true. Every single country that attempted to raise interest rates since the crisis in 2008 has failed. And we have failed too. So what happens if we drop? I mean, we're anchored at zero. Where are you going to go? -5? The answer is yes. I mean, I hate to tell you this.
Are you saying if you put your money in the bank, you got to pay to put your money in the bank? They're just going to take it?
It's what negative rates are.
Well, then why would anybody do that?
Digital. Because if you don't have a choice, if all wealth, if all money is digital, then that means that if you go out and you work or somebody pays your fee, it's going directly into the account. And they did a study, the IMF, and typically when I say they, I'm referring to central banks or the IMF. And the IMF is the International Monetary Fund, for those that aren't familiar with it. And its members are every Treasury Secretary and every central bank chief. in almost the world, 189 countries. So, by the way, neither one of them are elected officials. I'll just say this. You know, the biggest tool that they have is interest rates to inspire debt accumulation. So when you're anchored at zero, and they, of course, tested this in Europe, in Switzerland, et cetera, interestingly enough, because I've read a lot of those reports, it did not stimulate more borrowing. It didn't work. So the answer is, it is so interesting. It really is. Because you'll read 126 pages where they're telling you how it didn't work. And then in the very last part where they come to their conclusion, they talk about what a success it is. I mean, I'm thinking, wait a minute, these are your words that I'm reading. What am I missing here? It's because they can't look at the folly of their ways and because they don't have any other tools. That's why the system has to reset. And that's really where gold and why the central banks are accumulating gold, because they have to reset something that has no intrinsic value, the fiat money, against something that is all intrinsic value, which is gold with the broadest base of buyer. So what they do is this is just how it's happened over 4,800 times, and there's no other way to do it. So I'm thinking it's going to happen again.
Well, you know, I'm so sorry my show is so short, but I have to have you back on because what we just talked about is the beginning. It's the foundation.
Yeah.
The second part of our interview needs to be how you navigate it. And you just gave us a taste of that. How do you invest in gold? How do you take your money? What's the minimum you should do? It should be monthly. Should it be instead of putting it in the bank, should you just do that? I mean, there's a lot of different strategies I'd love to discuss with you. Do you recommend, I mean, gold is so expensive. Sounds like silver is a pretty good.
Okay, there's that perception management piece again. Gold is the biggest bargain on the planet. It is the gold and silver are severely undervalued to their true fundamental value. So when you're looking at how you know whether or not you should buy something, I feel so secure that you always need to know what's its real value. Not does what does Wall Street or the central bankers want you to think its value is. But to do that, and I don't care whether it's gold or silver or dollars or stocks or bonds or anything, real estate, it can be anything. And what you have to do is you have to go back to the beginning and say, okay, out of all these different functions that they perform, what is the single most important function? I determined that the single most important function of money was to hold its value over time, since that's what values your labor. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's the first piece that you have to know. Okay. Well, I want something that's going to stabilize my value. Well, the current monetary system we're in is debt based. Money is created from debt. So I'm never going to get you to the penny, but I'm going to get you pretty close because with debt or credit, that's infinite. They can keep growing debt and credit as long as people continue to have confidence in their abilities to repay it or do it back. Think about what backs the dollar. Full faith and credit of the government, right?
Right.
So as long as you trust them, you have faith, then you'll keep loaning them money. So the way to understand what the true fundamental value of gold is you take simply, you take all the debt that's been created. You can do it country to country. You can do it globally. And you divide it by all the gold that exists because we've definitely hit peak gold. We know, according to the Department of the Interior, they tell you how much gold is still left in the ground globally. And that gives you a number. So I just ran that number maybe, I don't know, 2 months ago, something like that. I just did a whole piece on how to get the fundamental value of any asset. And so the true fundamental value of an ounce of gold, if they were to do the reset today, is $11,500. So we're spot 17 something. A bargain, right?
Yeah.
You think the central banks are buying it because they're going to sell it at $3,500? No. They're buying it because they can translate that into the new monetary system. 100% of the time, over 6,000 years, you could always convert gold or silver into any currency, any good, or any service. but there are more than 4,800 currencies that no longer have value, that don't exist anymore. So you cannot say, you can't convert them, even going back to, the advent of the euro. Well, you're going to buy anything with Italian liras? Nope. It's not a money anymore. Because if a government can declare it a money, they can also declare that it is no longer money, which we just saw in India in 2016 when they demonetized 85% of their currency, forcing people into the digital system. And it's backfired on them. It didn't work very well. And that's not the only recent country, that's done that. That's just one example. They're also using this to, and they're not the only ones, using this to go in and quash the rebellions in their country. Hong Kong's doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Right. So, and guess what? Even in this country, some of Warren Buffett's companies have been doing that to quash unions, which have been declining. I mean, you can see the public unions have been going down, or the private unions have been going down dramatically over the years, as the public unions, the ones the states and the, and federal governments, those participants have been going up while the others have been going down. So, there are definitely people that benefit from this and benefit pretty substantially from this. But in reality, if you can do what they're doing for themselves, that's what they're doing. They know that 1700 is chump change. They know it. I know it. I'm paying the premium. I'm happy to pay the premium because it's getting very hard, like at ITM, because we always ethically, we don't legally have to do this, but our ethics say that we have to act as a fiduciary. In other words, we have to put your best interest, the client best interest first. When it's busy and gold is hard to get, guess who's not getting any?
Well, let me stop you because we're at the end of our show, but I want to continue on your YouTube. So if you can tell people how to find you, how to, learn how to invest with you, I wanted my listeners to know that.
Absolutely. Well, we're very visible and we love human contact. So they can find us at itmtrading.com, where they can call us at 888-696-4653. We are all working from home, but we're all still together. We meet regularly. I have an educational YouTube channel. So you can go into YouTube and put my name on. We're also on Brighteon. So everything that I film for YouTube also goes on Brighteon. And we're very accessible. And if you just Google my name, Lynette Zhang, then I think you'll probably find me. And I developed a strategy based upon repeatable patterns. And it does take gold and silver into account to help you survive and thrive. So that's how you find it.
Once again, Ms. Zhang, I'd like to thank you so much for coming on. It was an absolute pleasure. And I'd like to thank everybody for listening to Living the Solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.